Somers to Yonkers, Tarrytown to Portchester.
We've got Westchester covered.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Adventure Girl, explore your world.
Live from City Center at White Plains, Westchester Talk Radio presents the 24th edition of Fran's World. This is Jim Cleefield speaking. Fran's World is produced by Shark Creative and made possible by Entergy, Indian Point Energy Center. Hightower Westchester, your wealth is managed to a fiduciary standard. White Plains Hospital, exceptional every day. Westchester County Office of Economic Development, Robeson, the house that Service built, and Accorda Therapeutics, Life Science. And don't forget, please download the Westchester Talk Radio app on iTunes through the App Store at Westchester Talk. You can like us on Facebook at Westchester Talk Radio, and please follow us on Instagram. You can find us there at Shark Creative. And now the show starring the woman who really loves to talk. She's the world's fastest talking woman. She lives in her world, and you're welcome to it. It's Fran's World with your host, Fran Capo.
Hey, Jim. Thanks, and it's good to see you guys. It's been a month or two before I've spoken to you guys before. So we're here at City Center. We have everybody walking around. Everybody looks happy. The big weekend's coming up. And so, since I haven't seen you guys, I want to tell you what I've been doing last. First of all, my 21st book, New York Myths and Legends, came out. And that's all, like, if you guys like things like, you know, are there really alligators in the sewer? And who was the killer cook? You know, Typhoid Mary and Execution Rocks, where supposedly there are ghosts in a lighthouse. If you like that kind of stuff, that's the kind of book. Good end of summer reading book, and it gives you information that people don't know about. So anyway, that's my 21st book. And, you know, do you guys remember when I had Tom and Mark on from Father and Father, the movie that won 22 awards?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we did another movie called Sensei and the Goldman, and we just wrote the comedy script, and we actually won Best Comedy Script at the Action on Film Mega International Festival in Vegas. So we didn't even do the movie, and we already won something, so I like that. You know, eventually we'll have to shoot it, so hopefully it'll live up to its title. People will go, great script, but, you know, the movie sucked, but no. So hopefully everything will work out fine. And for my birthday, and that's why I wasn't here during July, thank you. I'm 37 again. I'm going to say 37 until I'm 97. All of a sudden, somebody's going to go, damn, that 37-year-old looks really old. Why is she on a cane in a wheelchair? But anyway, I decided to go out to Vegas, and I went with Steve and my son Spencer and his girlfriend Heather, and I decided, well, you know, what are you going to do for your 37th birthday again? So I decided I would jump off the stratosphere. I jumped off a building, 108-story building.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, so 108 stories. People, of course, are going, why the hell did you do that? And I was like, why not, you know? But it is a really weird thing because I've gone skydiving. And when you skydive, for some reason, it doesn't seem as scary because when you're in the plane and you're looking out, you're jumping into the clouds. So you don't have any perspective. But when you're in the top of the stratosphere, you see all those little tiny buildings down there. And you just see the platform looks like a dot.
Okay, so I have a question. So when you're up on the building there, and I'm assuming they're probably attaching something to the building to keep you somewhat tethered, so that way as you're going down, you know, there's a safety there?
Well, okay, so what it is, it's actually not like a zip line. It's actually, you're leaning out over the building, so it's like a little crane out there, so that, you know, if you fall, you don't mess the building up, only you. And but they have a decelerator, which is like you only go 45 miles an hour. So whether you weigh like 90 pounds or, 200 pounds, they measure it so that you only go 45 miles an hour down. And just think of it like a rappel down a mountain, so you're rappelling. But the thing is, you're stepping off a building, and that's the thing where people, you know, usually, you know, I was going, what should I say when I jump off? You know, the first word you really want to say is, oh, shit. You know, but, but then you're like, listen, this is, this is not network. I can say that. So I'm like, okay, I got to think. So I said a prayer all the ways down, and then I managed to plug my show, Love, Laughter, and Light, and someone said, how did you have the composure to think about that? But the other cool thing that happened while I was out in Vegas, because then we were staying at the Bellagio and everything, was I have this friend from a long time ago. His name is Jerry McCambridge, and he has the longest running show in Vegas, the longest running mentalist show out there in Vegas. And Jerry, I know Jerry because he and I had done stand-up comedy together many moons ago. He was also bending spoons, and I didn't believe him when we were out to dinner one time. And I'm like, hey, Jerry, bend this spoon. He's like, I don't think the people here are going to like me constantly bending all these spoons. So anyway, so I have Jerry on the line, and he is fantastic. So let me do this formal introduction here. Jerry McCambridge is the mentalist. His particular gifts set him apart from the average magician. He reads minds. He manipulates people's thoughts. You don't want to get into a fight with him. And completely leaves his audience spellbound, and he does it without a magic wand, half-naked showgirls, or elaborate props. He's always known what he's wanted. You got to read his book. He's got a book called The Mentalist. It's fantastic. And he's gone after it. He had an NBC one-hour special which aired internationally to millions worldwide. He's been hired by Fortune 500 companies as a keynote speaker. He's performed for all these mega celebrities at private parties. And like I had said, he's also been a Las Vegas Strip headliner since 2005 and has the longest running mentalist show in the history of Las Vegas. And according to the Las Vegas Review Journal Reader's Poll, he was voted the best magic show in Vegas. And you know what? I don't need that poll. I got to tell you, his show is fantastic. I've seen it a couple of times, and I still always want to go back. And I know the guy, and I'm like, this guy, he's just amazing. The audience is always like so wowed. Anyway, he's got a book out called The Making of the Mentalist, where he reveals everything that's happened in his life and how he overcame adversity, because he had some pretty hefty things happen him to being the superstar he is today. So anyway, Jerry's on the line. Let's talk to him. How you doing, Jerry?
Hey, guys. How are you?
I'm doing good.
That was the longest introduction in history. You should have did the fast talking for that.
I should have, but you know what? I got to let people know. And plus, we're going to be on the air a while. I know you're going, geez, I did all that stuff? That's, you know, maybe I should have told her just two sentences. So
felt anyway. Like a eulogy there. I was like pinching myself. Am I still alive?
Well, then just don't do too many more things, because the next time I have you on, I'm going to have to. It's going to be longer. I'll just say, listen to what I said the last show. Anyway, so I told you guys how I met. So, Jerry, not everybody knows what a mentalist is. So why don't we start by explaining what a mentalist is?
Oh, a mentalist is somebody who does magic of the mind, mind reading, manipulation, making predictions, doing entertainment without, unfortunately, half-naked showgirls. I made a wrong career decision. I should have did mentalism with the showgirls, but...
well, I got to tell you, when I said that, Matt goes, what was wrong with the naked showgirls? I was like,
nothing. I don't know where I went wrong with my career. Now I'm in a town full of half-naked showgirls. I'm the only one on stage who doesn't have them.
That's it. Well, they could go outside to look. They come inside to be entertained. Well, whatever.
Yes. So the show is me messing with people's heads. It's screwing with people's minds.
Yes, in a big way. And some of the stuff that you've done, I don't want to, like, reveal too much, you know, to give away. But, I mean, like, reading, you know, like, people will write things down on a piece of paper, and you're not looking at it, and half the show, you're with your eyes closed, and you're still able to, you know, say what they've written down. And these are all people you verify that you've never, you know, met before. So, you know,
I've been doing the show for 31 years now. I am so sick and tired of watching it. That's why I do have to show with my eyes closed. I'm just sick of seeing it.
Okay, well, then, you know what? The next time if I watch it, when I get to watching it 10, 20 times, I'm going to bring a blindfold myself. Okay? I'll be like, okay.
So let's go off your questions for a second. I was about a year and a half ago, I met a lady that I wanted to, you know, take out, and I was chasing her for a few months, and she finally agreed to go out with me, and I wanted to make the first date real romantic, so I took her to the top of the stratosphere to a restaurant up there, and the restaurant revolves, so
yes.
It takes about 45 minutes, and it makes a full revolution, and I totally forgot about you crazy people who like to jump off the stratosphere. So we're sitting there, and I asked for a window seat so we could see, and, you know, it's slowly turning, and we're talking and talking, and all of a sudden, as we're talking, somebody jumps off the top, like, because you jump off above us,
yep.
So you just go flying past us, so we're sitting there, I'm trying to be all romantic, She's like, what the hell was that? I go, I don't know. Oh, my God. So you guys are wacky. All you people jump up.
Well, you know, it's funny that you said that because we ate at that restaurant afterwards. And I was thinking, if someone doesn't know what's going on and you're having a conversation, you'd be like, did someone just commit suicide? What the hell just happened?
You know? That's exactly what it looked like. They go whizzing past you and you're like, what the hell? A few years prior to this girl, when I originally got divorced in 2004, I went on this reality TV show called Millionaire Matchmaker. Used to be on Bravo or something like that. So I go to LA and they have a big cocktail party.
I know Patty Stanger. Stanger? Patty Stanger. Yeah,
Patty Stanger.
Yep.
So I pick one girl out and we go on a date. So I fly her to Vegas and they said to me, like, before we did it, okay, so where do you want to take her? I was like, I don't know. What should we do? And they were like, we're going to come up with a bunch of ideas and you know, approve or deny them. And
okay.
One of them was jumping off the stratosphere. So they go, how would you like to do that? I go, on national TV, you want me screaming like a bitch coming flying down on a first date? Hell no. So...
Oh, that's funny. And you know, the thing is, I actually thought that I'm not a screamer. So to me, it's like when I do those things, people go, you're going to scream? I go, no, I'm not. And people are like, how do you look like you're so calm? I go, did you hear me in the beginning? I said, it's a lot higher and I'm scared. But you know, that girl who straps you in, she's like in the military. She's like, turn around, make a left, don't look down, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, she doesn't want to hear anything. She's just like, lady, jump. She doesn't care. But so what'd you wind up doing on your date? What was the exciting thing? Did you take on a
military girl?
Was that the high point or the low point?
I saw your clip and I saw that girl, you know, that was strapping you in, the military girl.
Yeah.
And that actually made me feel good because she, you know, me and you have been doing comedy for so long, and that's what we like to do. We like to make people laugh. And in an uncomfortable situation like that, you want to make somebody laugh. And I'm thinking, you know, you're talking up there, you're going, oh my God, it's a lot longer, you know, a lot further than it looks. And she just stayed the course in terms of doing her job. You know, testing, click, back thing, click.
I know.
So I'm going, man, she's got her routine that she does down pat to make sure that you're safe, and she's not listening to you at all.
I know.
So I felt comfortable that she was doing it that way.
Oh, that's interesting, because I was going, this woman has no sympathy. What if I said I didn't want to? But the funniest part was she was so deadpan when she was doing it, but then she goes, we got to take a picture, and then we turn around, and in the picture, she's smiling like she's all happy. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, picture. But then she's back to, all right, move your plate over there. Don't look down, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, it was quite an experience. And congratulations. And now, you're dating that. Well, you said you're dating this girl now, right?
Oh, no.
That was back then.
Okay. I broke up a while ago.
All right. So let's get back into, because, you know, my show is about humor, health, happiness, and living your dreams. And you seem to have known. First of all, let's go back because, you know, I love people knowing somebody's history. So you were raised by loving adoptive parents who, and you never searched for your real mom, right? Right. And your parents, you did not. And your parents saw that you were into the magic, I mean, and into this, and they helped you. They were like, sure, here's a deck of cards. What was the first thing that made you, because I read the book, but other people haven't yet. What was the thing that made you decide this is what you wanted to do?
So I was doing magic as a kid. You know, I started at like 9 years old or something like that. And soon after I started, like within 2 years or something like that, my parents started to get divorced. They were going through a divorce process. Now, this was, you know, 40-some-odd years ago. So divorce was not like a big thing back then. It was a rarity.
Right.
So I'm this little kid that everybody knows is adopted. So I kind of have this big scarlet letter on my chest. And then now my parents are getting divorced. So now I got the scarlet letter on my chest and my back.
Right.
So the performing became what made me an individual, what made me different. It gave me attention in a positive way. And I liked that. So I pursued it and kept going. So in 1974, my older brother gave me a ticket to see a Broadway show. It was my very first Broadway show. It was called The Magic Show. It was Doug Henning. And Doug had the long hair and the big buck teeth.
Yep.
And, you know, he looked like a psychedelic rabbit. During the show, he would call somebody up on stage to inspect the trunk. You know, you get in the trunk and you tie it up, and then you stand on top, and the magician and the girl switch places. So he picks me out of the audience. I raise my hand, and he picks me, and I go up, and I inspect this trunk. And I'm focused. Like, I'm not doing anything but inspecting the trunk. And then he hands me the keys to the lock after he locks the girl in, and he says, go stand over there, so he could do the whole magic thing. So I stand off to the side, and I looked up, and this was at the Court Theater in New York City. And I looked up and I saw, you know, 1,500 people or whatever it was. It was a sold out show. And I'm thinking the average kid or maybe the average person would kind of like shit themselves at that point and go, right. What the hell? But I'm standing there going, this is great. Oh my God, I love this.
Wow.
And like, if a priest has a calling, that was my calling.
That was your calling.
Going,
yeah.
This is what I got to do for the rest of my life. And, I snuck backstage to see Doug after the show and talked to him, and he gave me a ton of words of advice and mentoring and wisdom, and said, you come back and see me anytime you want. And I used to go into the city every Saturday, and I used to go see him between his first and second show.
You know what? That's amazing. And the other thing, too, is that he allowed you to do that. You know, because someone would say, all right, go away, kid, you bother me. But he was really nice in doing that. But I remember reading also, because of that, it affected one of your goals to perform 1,295 times, right?
Well, my first goal, soon after that happened, because my birthday was on Halloween, so I got the tickets for my birthday. So soon after that, Doug had a show on NBC called Doug Henning's World of Magic, and it was a live one-hour magic show. So I'm watching this, you know, and I'm all proud as a kid. Oh, that's my friend over there. Yay. And he used to tell me about the show when I used to go see him, so I kind of knew what was going to happen. So when it came time to sit down and write goals, I thought, I want to do what he's doing. I want to have a show in New York City. And then later on, I was like, yeah, what the hell, if I'm writing goals, if you're reaching for the stars, you know, you just keep reaching. You don't say, well, they're too high. So I also said, yeah, and I want, you know, a TV show, too. He had a TV show on NBC. I want a TV show on NBC.
And then he went
out to Vegas, and I said, I want a Vegas show. So I was kind of copying what he was doing, but then I decided, you know, he was in New York a really long time. I want to break the amount of shows that he's doing. I want to break the record. So I was able to calculate some way. I guess I Googled it. I don't remember. But I figured out how many shows he did, and I wanted to put his to shame. So
nice.
Whatever
the number
is, this
is a little
like
bratty kid. No, okay.
Yeah. So I love to squash and destroy goals. I love to set them up. I've systematically learned how to destroy them, and I've done it my whole life.
Well, that's the thing that is amazing. If anybody reads your book, which is called The Making of the Mentalist, that you systematically show people, I set this goal. But what I love about your book is that you actually not only say, hey, I set this goal, I break this goal. You actually show everything you did, you know, how you marketed it, what you did, you know, going, how you made your own props at one point when you couldn't, you know, afford a prop, how you would negotiate with people. So it actually shows some of the process of like, wow, I could do that. And that's what's so cool about your book and you being also a motivational speaker, is because you don't just say, hey, I'm here. Hey, try to catch me. You're like, I'm here, but let me tell you how to reach your goals of what you want too.
Right.
But, you know,
it got annoying after a while. You know, when I did my TV show.
That was The Mentalist. This was The Mentalist show on NBC, right? Go ahead.
Correct. It was the first Mentalist show. It was on NBC before the CBS Mentalist version. And when I would show up at different things like magic conventions or stuff like that after the book, I used to hear some people talking, oh, look at McGainbridge, why did he have a show? You know, I'm a better person. performing than him? Why did he, you know, what did networks give him a show for? And, you know, I was like, why? Because I worked for it, you know, because it was something that I wanted and I went after. And you think just sitting doing Herschel's bar mitzvah, you know, somebody's going to be there and like discover you and say, I want to give you an ABC show. Like, it doesn't work that way. And I wanted to show in the book that, yeah, that there's a way to do it. I just didn't sit back and, you know, in the olden days you get discovered. Oh, I'm a singing waiter. I get discovered and now I'm in an MGM movie. You know, it doesn't work that way.
Right. Everybody has that image. You're like, oh, yeah, so-and-so was sitting at a bar and then a producer just walked in. We're like, yeah, right. How did she know, you know, that the person was a singer sitting at the bar? They obviously had it. You know what I mean? And that's the thing is people don't realize how much work goes into it. And then when you get it, it's like, remember what Billy Crystal said? 25 years to become an overnight success. It's not like you're just sitting there doing nothing going, oh, I did a couple of magic shows. And all of a sudden they go, yeah, Jerry, out of everybody, we're going to give him a show. I watched the way, I loved that your book. Seriously, I really loved it because it was showing like how you negotiated with people and what you were willing to do and what you weren't willing to do. And, you know, the integrity you kept all along of things that, you know, you did along the way. But now, the other thing is, I don't even know if you still have it. For people who live out in Vegas, do you still have that website that you created for Vegas locals?
No, I sold that.
Okay, so but that was another great idea. You know, you had that website where people could come see the shows. You were always figuring out ways to market. Now, the other thing is because I'm the type of person, I've gone through, you know, some trials and tribulations. You know, my house burning down, held up at gunpoint 3 times, blah, blah, blah. And in your book, you talk about there was this one guy that you had to overcome with the child abuse with Mr. Qualis in Bayside High, which is the same school that my husband, Steve Davis, went to. And he knew that guy. And he was like, you know, he never came after me. But that guy, you know, a lot of people, you know, it's like creepy when you see it on TV that, you know, somebody comes after somebody. But I love what you did to bring that to the forefront. And so let's touch on that a little for somebody who might feel like they're a victim and they can't figure out a way to get, so to speak, back at somebody or at least, you know, let people know what's happened. Tell them what you did.
Well, so I was probably, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old. I forgot what it was. And so now my father leaves. My mother has to get a job, and I'm kind of this little kid looking for a male figure in my life. And when I used to go to woodshop class and I was making all of my magic tricks, you know, I was bored making the spice rack and the paper towel holder. And
for Herschel's bar mitzvah.
I wanted to make things that I can use in my show. And the woodshop teacher noticed this and was like, oh, what are you making? What are you making? And he took an interest in me. And he did everything that pedophiles do in terms of grooming me to bring me in and you know, make me part of his family. And he used to take me to his house. And I used to hang out with his kids and perform at his kids' birthday parties. And eventually he wound up, you know, raping me. And it was like a total, really bad mind screw because they make it seem like it's okay, you know, like there's nothing wrong with it. So very quickly I realized there was something wrong, and the school year ended, and I severed all ties with him. And so I carried the guilt of that, because when you're a male, you know, you don't want to admit that that has happened. You know, and this was before any Me Too movement or anything.
Right.
This was, you know, 40 years ago. And the more time that goes by, you know, the more you want to try and forget it, but then you don't want to do anything about it because you don't want to say something to somebody and then they go, you know, oh, well, why didn't you say anything, you know, 5 years ago? And a lot of times you block it out or you try and process it differently. So when I was writing the book, I spoke to a lawyer and I said, hey, I want to write this book. And I actually, Simon & Schuster was originally involved in the book. And they said, you can write about it, but you can't mention his name. You can't do anything that ties him to you. Somebody can't read your book. If somebody reads your book, they can't figure out who it is. And I was like, why? I did nothing wrong. I actually, you know, when I got divorced at one point, I was going through counseling just to get my head together. And that came up and the counselor was like, whoa, this is some major stuff here.
Right.
And I wound up up realizing it helped add to the divorce. It helped, you know, in terms of me not being as open and as loving as I should be with my wife, because I have this...
Right, the guy messed you up mentally. You had to figure out a way to conquer that.
Right. So I wrote about it in the book. I severed ties with Simon & Schuster, and I said, you know something? I did nothing wrong. And that's what victims really need to understand, that this was his problem. It wasn't mine. I got caught up in his spider web of bullshit, you know. And when you come to that realization, you know, because they make you think that you want this or you asked for this, or, you know, and that's not the way that it happens. So, I wrote about it in the book. The lawyer told me, you can mention his name, you can mention anything that you want, because he has to come after you for writing falsehoods in the book. And I was like, let him come after me, because then that'll be great publicity that people will see what happened. And, you know, and then I can really open the story up big time. So I put everything in the book. I don't know if you remember it. His picture is in there.
Yes, and I love that. I was so happy you did that. I was like, damn it, I hope he mentions a guy. I was so happy that you did that, because that's their anonymity, them thinking they're never going to get caught. But once you say, oh, here's your picture, and by the way, you know, this is where you live, and by the way, would you like your kids to know about this, what kind of person you are? And how about your grandkids? Would you like that? You know, people got to be accountable for the shit they do. And so I think it was great. And your book, you were just like so open in your book. It's like, I love it. So it just adds to it. And the other thing that's really cool is in your show, you are one of the few mentalists that add a lot of humor in the show. So it's not just people being like, wow. It's like you really give your heart out there. And that's what makes you different from the other mentalists. So the thing is, like, if people go to Vegas and you work now, but now you have what, six kids and like a grandkid, and you're doing the show now. So what is your goals now? Like, what's your, you know, what are you working on now? I know you're doing the show all the time. Is there anything else for Jerry coming up?
Well, this is not going to be good for your show. So I always set goals and I always chase them. And as I'm chasing a goal and getting there, I usually set other goals and recalibrate goals, which is great. And at one point in my life, I realized that I was chasing goals so much that I was forgetting to stop and enjoy the goals. Not the goals, accomplishing the goals. So at this point in my life, I said, you know, I had the TV show, I have kids, I have grandkids. I think I'm going to enjoy what I'm doing now. Every mentalist in the world would want. They would want to be a Vegas headliner.
You're already that. You're that already.
I'm going to stop and enjoy it. I go to work every night. I do 7 nights a week. I love to go to work. I love to speak to people. I love to talk about my book and my adversities. So in terms of goals, am I looking to do a movie or am I nothing? I'm looking to enjoy what I have accomplished.
You didn't think that was going to be good for my show. You're absolutely, it's the opposite, because I talk about, like, you have to enjoy life. That's why I do my adventure. That's why people are like, you're always off doing this thing and that thing and that thing. I'm like, well, what? Life is a buffet table. I want to try all these things. I want to do it with different people, like, you know, bring my husband, bring my son. And I make sure that I spend every Sunday with my kid and that I just really enjoy it. Because then otherwise, when you look back on your life, you go, yeah, the times you miss is the special moments. And you don't want to miss that in life. So that's a really important message you just gave to everybody. Not just always have to keep. It's just, you know, hey, I've got almost all my stuff. I am satisfied. And that is something that very few people are. So you've accomplished something that a lot of people don't accomplish in their life. But just in case people do want to see your 75-minute work week, you know, every night that you do, they can go to the V Theater in Miracle Mall, which is in Planet Hollywood. And the show is 7 days a week at 7:30. And it's 365 days a year, or no?
not 365. I do take some time off.
Thank
I'll be
God.
In New York in December.
Okay,
but
good.
I do work 7 days a week. So I haven't had a day off probably in about 2 months now.
Okay. See, well, we got to make sure the mentalist, you know, has some mental relieving of their minds here. So people, how can people find out about your show to get tickets?
Mentalist.com. Couldn't be any easier.
Okay, guys, unless you don't know how to spell, it's MENTALIST.com, mentalist.com. And also check out his book, The Making of the Mentalist. I'm telling you, it's one of the best shows in Vegas. You got to see it when you're out there. And if you want to see the naked women, you can walk out on the street. But you want to see Jerry. He's fantastic. Thank you so much, Jerry. And we'll be right back in a few minutes with more Fran's World right here in City Center. Stay tuned.
Look outside your window. What would you like to see? Imagine all the things that could be done to beautify your property. At Michael Labriola, we've led the field over 35 years. Our expert staff brings all their best to give you what you need.
For more than 40 years, Michael Labriola Incorporated has provided complete landscape construction and site development services that will add beauty, enjoyment, and value to your property. Want to make some changes to your landscape this spring? Maybe extending your living space to the outdoors with a functional outdoor kitchen or adding a patio or walkway? Michael Labriola Incorporated can evaluate your property and offer creative ideas. 914-273-6530. Commercial properties always welcome. Learn more at michaellabriolainc.com.
Michael Labriola, our last name is the first name in landscapes.
News, trends, and more.
No one knows Westchester County better than we do.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
You're back with Fran's World Live at City Center in White Plains. And my next guest is on the line right now. I'm very excited. This is the first time I'm talking to her, but she has done some fantastic things. Cynthia Lowen, she's a filmmaker, writer, a director of a film called Netizens. So that's like citizens on the internet. Get it? Netizens. It's a documentary film about women and online harassment featuring three women who are the targets of vicious cyber attacks. The movie follows them as they confront digital abuse and strive for equality and justice online. So the film features Brooklyn attorney Carrie Goldberg and Anita Sarkazian. I'm sure Cynthia will correct me later. And others will have been attacked, and others who have been attacked and premiered at the 2018 Tribeca Film Festival. Now the thing is, you know, now more than ever, women's rights are in the forefront of both politics and the art. And what Cynthia is doing is she's using her film to make a difference. Cynthia Lowen and others have been successful, which is fantastic, in getting some protection laws in place here in New York City. Currently, she's launching a community screening tour that's going to start on September 23rd, and she'll give you all the details, but from D.C., Chicago, San Francisco, Miami, and her goal is to catalyze action from law enforcement, tech companies, and policymakers to reduce online violence against women. And what she wants to be able to do is to be able to empower audiences to take an active role in fostering constructive digital communities, and so that, you know, people, well, we're going to talk more about that in a second. New York City will feature a brief talk back following a screening of Netizens in New York City on September 23rd at 7:30 at AMC Empire 25, which is 234 West 42nd Street. So people, do you have a pen on you? Write it down again. 234 West 42nd. Don't worry, I'm going to repeat it 50 times. Which is at Times Square between 7th and 8th Avenue. So please welcome, after that long introduction, she's probably going, geez, you said everything I was going to say. Cynthia Lowen, how are you, Cynthia?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Fran.
Oh, you're welcome. Gail had told me about your film, and I thought it was fascinating. I actually watched it, and obviously there's a lot of people in there. So let's start, because obviously I've seen the film, and my audience has not. So tell our listeners, first of all, how you came up with this subject. Is this your first film?
So this is my first film that I've directed, but I also produced and wrote the film called Bully, which came out in 2012 with the Weinstein Company.
Oh, yes. Oh, I remember that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I judged only when you said that other thing. I was like, wait, okay. But yes, bullies was, and that's another topic that is so important to cover. So you did that film, and now you came on this film. So have you always been, like, always with films with, these are huge purpose films, you know? I mean, it's not just entertainment. This is huge purpose films.
Yeah, you know, I think that this film really came out of our experience with Bully, and when we started that film, we thought, you know, this is really crazy. You know, so many of us grew up with bullying as such an intrinsic and really traumatizing part of our childhood. And for so many people, it was like, oh, well, yeah, that's just middle school, or that's just adolescence, or that's just boys being boys or kids being kids. And we were kind of like, well, you know, there were a lot of young people who were taking their lives around 2009, 2010, and we were like, this is not normal. It was being connected to having the experience of being bullied by these children who were harming themselves. So we thought, let's take a look at this and see if, you know, maybe it's not normal. Maybe it's not something we have to accept in our schools and communities. And what we saw coming out of that film was, you know, a huge movement in schools, not just across the United States, but around the world.
Oh, really?
To say, you know, we're going to stop this. We're going to have principals taking pledges. We're going to get teachers educated on how to deal with it and not just tell, you know, the person who's been targeted and the bully to shake hands and forget about it and move on.
Exactly.
So what we did with that film was really, I think, transform the conversation around bullying from something that was just like, well, that's just something you're going to have to put up with, to say, no, that's not something we have to put up with.
Well, remember when you were young that they used to have that thing, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me? And that's actually not true, because when people start saying things, especially in the digital age, it's like, you know, all right, so somebody said it to you in the playground. All right, maybe the 20 people heard it or the whole school didn't. But now it's like the whole world hears when somebody says something about you.
Yeah.
And that's on, you know, lives on the internet forever, you know?
Absolutely. So, you know, this film definitely came out of that film in that moment, because so many parents were saying, you know, we made Bully right before every child had a cell phone that had a camera and was attached to the internet, and, you know, it was right before kids were online all the time.
Right.
And after the film came out, parents started saying, hey, have you seen what's going on the internet? This is really devastating. And so netizens really grew out of looking at that, and I decided that I didn't want to make another film about youth, even though youth are so, you know, impacted by online harassment. I decided that I wanted to look at what was happening with women specifically, and it came out of hearing about Anita Sarkeesian, and in the fall of 2014, she and several other women who were prominent in the gaming industry were the targets of these coordinated online mobs that went after them. They published their addresses. They published, you know, numerous death threats, very specific death threats. And so a number of women had to leave their homes. They were, you know, every time Anita would go out and speak publicly, she was in danger. There were major bomb threats at speeches that she was giving. And I was like, this is really, you know, the attitude was like, oh, yeah, well, that's the internet. The internet's the Wild West. If you don't like it, get offline.
You know, which
and
is,
again,
right. And Anita, just so people understand what you were saying, what exactly was she doing? Because they're not going to understand why it's just because she's in gaming that, you know, people were going after her.
So Anita has this great series called Feminist Frequency, and it's really talking about how are women, it's looking at how women are represented in video games. And it's really, you know, it's clever, it's funny, it's really spot on, and it's like a really great look at, you know, how are women depicted in video games? How are they devices? What does that mean for, you know, the bigger gaming community to kind of see images of women all the time as
half naked, you know, and, you know, they, you know, the shots always up the butt instead of, you know, like the
totally.
Way they just
totally. So, you know, she was critiquing, you know, hey, let's look at what's going on here, and that kind of brought on this mob that was very violently threatening her. So that kind of started this journey for this film. You know, I woke up one morning and was hearing a radio report about what had happened to her, and also that she couldn't get intervention from law enforcement. you know, law enforcement was like, well, you know, we don't know if that's a real death threat. They could be, you know, in another country. They could be 1,000 miles away.
So, but and they wouldn't even investigate it? They wouldn't even investigate it?
She took it to numerous law enforcement officials and was not getting any protection or response.
Even though she was having people that were giving her these threats and showing up at the places, they did not consider that that was a threat.
Yes, yes.
It's disgusting. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So it really highlighted this huge problem, which was that there's not a lot of intervention when you're receiving threats online. And, you know, nobody receives a threat by, like, you know, someone, like, all right, I'm sure it still happens, but, like, it's not like people threatening you these days or mailing you a letter.
Right, so right. And, like, and they always hide behind the anonymity of the whole thing. It's like they're cowards.
Right.
They're cowards. It's like,
right.
Oh, I'm going to threaten you, but I'm not going to tell you who I am. Yeah, well, why don't you show, you know, let me see who you are. I'm sorry. I'm an old-fashioned Italian. You're gonna threaten me, I'm going to punch you in the face. You know, you tell me what's your problem, you know? I am allowed to speak my piece. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, seeing, like, what she went through and then kind of digging more deeply into, like, what's going on here, what I discovered is that, you know, these women who are threatened violently with these threats, it's really hard to get law enforcement or protection. And then there's a whole other realm of forms of digital abuse, like, you know, what's often called revenge porn.
Right.
But, you know, the person, it's a misnomer because, you know, revenge has nothing to do with it. It's abuse. And the extent to which these privacy violations are, you know, women are losing their jobs, they're losing their relationships with their families, they can't date, they can't have a public life online because
their pictures are
viral.
Right, and let's explain that because somebody hearing this, you know, you need sometimes to give people details to understand. And in the film, you actually do because you're actually seeing not necessarily what they placed on there, but for example, in Anita's case, that you could actually, you're showing what they're writing, like, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill your mother. I mean, you're showing, so you're not just giving, you know, like, oh, they're just saying mean things. These are actual serious, scary threats. And the other thing too is this is what they call it, so we'll call it this, the revenge attacks, cyber attacks, right? Is that what it's called?
Well, often people, the nude pictures, and people share nude pictures, it's often been called revenge porn.
Right.
But, you know, what we're calling it now is image exploitation or non-consensual image exploitation.
Well, now let me ask you something, because you're saying that you're going to affect, like, New York laws. You know, like when you go and you're in a public place or whatever and you take a picture, and a lot of times you have to, you know, get a release. Like when you're doing a movie, you have to get a release form if somebody's face is there. Now, all of a sudden, somebody who you trust, and you've gone out with them for 2 years or whatever the hell, how long you've gone out with them. And then you break up with them and they don't like the idea that you broke up with them. And while you were into it with them, whatever, they took a couple of pictures and now they decided to put these pictures out there. This is the type of stuff that we're talking about. And so what happens is then when someone goes for a job, you know, everybody searches, you know, backgrounds of people on the internet. And then what happens is their employee sees this and they're like, oh, you know, we can't have this person working. Even if you explain, hey, this was, you know, what was going on, you know, they don't want. But the other thing that you talked about in the film, which I thought was crucial, was it's not only these people doing things without your permission and basically, you know, trying to get back at you and ruin your life, which really can, because who's, you know, want to date you if you all of a sudden there's this picture of you in a compromising position with somebody else. You know what I'm saying? Like, it ruins so many different levels, and then your parents, and it's so many different things. But the fact that some people are hacking into people's websites and pretending they are that person and writing these things and inviting others in to make it look like these women are hookers.
I mean, it's a huge problem. And, you know, the number of women who are filmed without their knowledge, you know, there's lots of situations in which someone may decide to share an intimate picture with someone they trust. there's also lots of situations where they're not even aware that they've been filmed. They're not aware that this video exists until they try to leave the person. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, if you leave me, guess what? You're never going to find, a job again or a boyfriend again or a relationship again. And then the impersonation is also a huge thing. So, you know, one of the women who I filmed with, she had someone who was consistently hacking into her Facebook accounts and was emailing and messaging people, propositioning them. And she was having to go to all these people and say, that wasn't me. I'm not sending you these propositioning messages. Someone is trying to hijack my identity and totally ruin my reputation with my community. And it happens all the time. And in that case, she was pretty sure that there had been a piece of software that was put on her phone. And there's all kinds of kind of spyware and malware and stuff like this, keystroke software that captures everything you type into your computer or your phone. So if you reset your password, but your phone or computer has been infected with this keystroke software, every single thing you type into your computer, including your new password, is being sent to the perpetrator.
Wow. Is there any stuff that can detect when you have that spyware, like that it would say, hey, guess what? Someone put spyware on there. Is there a program like that?
That's a really good question. I think there are some programs where you can look at what's running on your computer, what's running on your phone. But for the average person, it's really hard to tell when you're getting this feed out of, you know, well, that program's doing this and that's doing that. You know, I've done this on my phone and on my computer before just to see how these work. And if you don't know what all that computer code means, it's really hard.
And also, the thing is, why you suspect that you wouldn't be suspecting, let me check my computer, you know.
Right. So often women will discover that this has been put on their phones or their computers because the perpetrator knows things that they wouldn't otherwise know. So in this one young woman's example, the perpetrator was sending her text messages that she had sent to other people.
To let her know, like, guess what? I know everything you're doing.
I'm watching you. Yeah. And another woman I filmed with, the perpetrator had... knew where she was, including when she went to a lawyer to try to get protection.
Oh, that's scary, right.
And they knew that she had been to an attorney. So what this gets into is the fact that, you know, this cyber abuse and cyber digital abuse and online harassment really overlaps with domestic violence. And that was one of the big surprises in this film, is that, you know, it's not just people who, you know, strangers sending threats, but I think the sort of bigger preponderance, and often in these cases, the people who are being victimized, you know, are silent victims because they're terrified, is this digital stalking, hacking into computers, having photos of them that are intended to prevent them from leaving the relationship. I think a lot of women are in abusive situations where the person has pressured them into giving them photos or taking photos, and then those photos are used to threaten that if they leave their partner, and let's say they have children with them, that they'll never get
custody of the kid.
Children.
Right. And the thing is, when you're in an abusive relationship, the person, I mean, it's all fine and good, because I always believe you need to be your own best cheerleader and don't become a victim, because a victim mentality can't help you become strong. But at the same time, you are victims. People do become victims of things at a time. And you have to... the guest that I had on before had actually... And he was a guy, had been raped when he was in high school. He actually wrote a book and put the guy's picture in the book. And the thing... So if you could, you know, let people know, because it's almost... But... You know the thing is out there. So what your film is trying to do is raise awareness, because people who aren't experiencing it don't know the level to which it's happening. And they don't realize also the post-traumatic syndrome that goes along with this. Because even if it's resolved, you're still nervous. I mean, like I was held up a couple of times. And one time I was pregnant, and I was on the third floor of my house, and all of a sudden I heard a noise, and I look out and I see the guy's face in, and he's trying to break in, and you know, whatever. And at that time I owned a shotgun, and I called the police and I said, there's a guy in my balcony. They said, well, did he break in? And I was like, no, he didn't break in. He's on the third floor balcony to break in. I am pregnant. And they said, well, ma'am, if he's not inside the house, I said, I'll tell you what, I have a shotgun and I'll use it. They said, all right, we'll be right over. And but the thing is, for months afterwards, every time I walked into my apartment, even though I knew the guy wasn't there, I had that feeling like, oh my God, is that guy's face going to be on the other side of that window? Like, you have that nervousness of, is somebody still going to be there? So with your film now coming around and all the things that you're saying and revealing in the film, and how did you find those women, by the way? How did you find your subjects for the movie?
All different ways. Anita, of course, was quite prominent in you know, news stories about what she had experienced. So I reached out to Anita directly. And then the next thing I did was I was like, well, who would know who's being targeted? And so I reached out to attorneys and lawyers. There are not many lawyers who are taking these cases. And so it's a really, really tight community of attorneys who are representing people who are going through this. And Carrie Goldberg is one of those attorneys. And when I met her...
And she's in your film, just so people know. She's yeah.
Yeah, and she's a powerhouse. She's amazing. She just had a book come out called Nobody's Victim. And she had just started this internet privacy law firm when I met her, and over the next few years, it just exploded and has become a real force for good. But she herself had gone through this, and she started her firm because she couldn't get law enforcement to intervene. She couldn't find an attorney to represent her, and she took justice into her own hands. And then Tina Riney, who I filmed with in Miami, I met through a great organization. So for people who are going through this, there is an organization called the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative.
Say that again, just so people... It's Cyber Civil Rights...
Cyber Civil Rights Initiative.
Okay.
And they have a helpline. They have a coalition of attorneys that they can help put people in touch with who need to talk to... get legal help. They have lots of resources for people who are being targeted. And Tina had gone to them to try and get help for what she was going through, and that was how I got in touch with Tina. And then there's several other women in the film: Soraya Kamali, Danielle Keith Citrin, Jamia Wilson, Marianne Franks, who are all just incredible thinkers and are so outspoken and have, you know, honestly, I've just followed in these amazing footsteps that they've created.
And you know, the cool from them. And what the cool thing about the film also was, it wasn't like all the same type of thing. One was, you know, their identity was being hacked. Another one was, you know, the revenge. I'm sorry, I keep forgetting what you call it, but the revenge porn was put on. And then another one was, you know, so it was showing all the different types of ways that women are being. So now, when you say that you affected New York City law, what actually were you able to do?
Well, Carrie Goldberg was really the driving force behind working with Assemblymember Brownstein's office in pushing for a non-consensual image exploitation, aka revenge porn bill, that was recently passed in the New York State Senate. And working with, you know, the partners that we are doing the impact work with this film, what we want to do with this film is, again, it's not just something to see in the movie theaters and get on with your life. What we really want is for this to be something that people use to educate their policymakers, law enforcement officials, and other people who are really in a position to affect change.
Right. And, you know, have you going to go into schools also, maybe?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, unfortunately...
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. We actually have been doing film festivals around the world, and in Norway, we had like 1,000 kids see this film at the
wow.
high school level, and they just totally connected with everything that's going on.
That is awesome, because kids are with social media, and if they start promoting that, you know what I mean? That's what you want, is to get the name
yep.
out now so people know about it. Now, unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I just want to make sure to let people know they could go to the website, which is, you know, www.netizens with an S, NETIZENS film.org. That's netizensfilm.org. And there's info, the trailers, the time, the dates of the showing of New York City, D.C., Miami, San Francisco. And again, it's September 23rd is going to be the first one. It's 7:30 at AMC Empire 25, which is the one at Times Square between 7th and 8th Avenue. Is there anything else you want to add? Is there tickets that people have to buy? Or?
Yep, there's tickets available, and I'm just going to do a quick update. It's actually netizensfilm.com.
Oh, netizensfilm.com. Okay. Okay,
but
so
we will be having a panel on Monday night, September 23rd, 7:30 p.m., Times Square AMC. I will be there to answer questions and talk about the film. We'll have a great group of special guests, and we're really excited for a great event that will really move us all out into the world to be part of tackling this.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on the work that you're doing and the work that you're going to do, and I hope everybody sees the film so that you could raise awareness. Great job, and again, people, go out and see it. Don't just say, oh, this is terrible. Oh, my gosh. Go do something about it. Go see the film. Tell people about it. And don't just sit on your butt. Go do something about it. All right? So, again, netizensfilm.com. Check it out. Cynthia Lowe, thank you so much for being on the show. And everybody, that wraps up my show. I'll be back.
Thank you so much, Fran.
You're welcome. We'll be back with Fran's World the last Friday of every month. We'll see you again in September. And remember, it's your life. Create a good one.
Shark, Shark Creative.
Thank you, listener. Yes, Shark Creative is the company you think of for on-hold messages. If you want to hear how it helps, you can call Mercedes-Benz of New Rochelle, Durante Rentals, Michael Labriola, Inc., Oak Ridge Staffing, Emma's Ale House, Northeast Environmental, or just go to sharkcreative.com and listen there. Meanwhile, we've expanded our services as your all-audio resource. On-hold messages, of course, production and placement of radio campaigns on the Pete and others too, and now we also have our very own internet radio station, Westchester Talk Radio. Look for us on Facebook at Westchester Talk. Have us come out to your next event, help you capture audio from your sponsors, associates, friends. Bite into that first impression with Shark Creative. Everything audio. It just sounds better.
Shark Creative.